Well, greetings, Massive. Lanco on your video here. And we are interviewing, having the privilege of interviewing Josh, frontman for The Skints, one of our favorite bands in the whole world, especially at the moment and in current times. Josh, welcome, and thank you for being a part, taking part in this interview. We're very excited to do this with you today.
Thanks, Lance. The pleasure's mine, and yeah, big up. Respect.
Yeah, man, thank you. Thank you. Start by telling us where and how the band began. I know you guys were awfully young when it started, and when did it start and how and all of that?
All right, so we're probably going back, wow, about 14 years now.
What year was that?
And, so in Northeast London, in the outer Northeast London area.
In what year?
In England, in the UK. We're going back to like 2007 at this point.
Okay.
Actually, maybe a year or two earlier than that, some of us are starting to come together and just play music in general. But the four people you know as the Skints today kind of settle on the lineup in like, yeah, the May of 2007. So I'm going back. I'm like 16 at this point.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's kind of, you know, a band forming as so many do in the most primitive way, which is just, you know, young friends around that age trying to make something together, you know, that we like, that everyone else in our school and in our neighborhood isn't really into, but we think it's cool, you know.
Well, you know, it sounds like you went through a couple of different band members. How did you settle on the ones that are in the current lineup?
Yeah, I mean, it was, like I said, it was kind of very, you know, it was like school days or whatever. So, and we went to like just kind of a pretty, what's called like a comprehensive or a secondary modern here, which is just like,
yeah,
it's like a big school. It was maybe like 1,500 kids.
Okay.
And, you know, there are no, like anyone can go there. It's not like any kind of specialist school or, you know, it's just like the free local school kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was kind of just like us being kids and playing music with people, you know, the rare kids that also like played instruments or whatever. But like the four of us, well, you see, we were kind of generally, we were all into like really different music, to be fair, but we kind of definitely all agreed in kind of like the punk rock side of things and like the ska and the reggae side of things. That was kind of in like the Venn diagram of what we were into.
Right.
That was kind of in the middle, you know? So.
Well, yeah, it seems like you've maintained that sound throughout the essence of the band and still seems to be the very core of the band, which is great. So when you guys started, who, obviously you didn't have original music right away. So who were you guys kind of, what kind of covers were you guys practicing? And then how did the transition happen to original music?
Yeah, I think honestly, by this point, we were kind of with the original music, like, pretty early on. Like,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely some covers in there. There were definitely, you know, we were messing around with, like, I don't know, like, Operation Ivy and King Prawn was, like, a big ska punk band for us over here, and Cap Down, a couple bands like that. When we were kind of, like, testing out the sound and, like, see how it worked. Definitely more on that Scarflex, and we always and still do to this day, like cover like reggae classics that we like and stuff. So
yeah,
you know, what we play early on, it would have been like Toots and the Maytals and some Wailers and stuff like that.
Okay.
Abyssinians and Johnny Clark and
yeah,
the more root stuff like that, you know, when we were kind of like kind of learning the kind of craft, if you like, and figuring out like the role of each instrument, you know, because we in the band, everyone's role is like sonically is like really different, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
With yeah. like between the drums, bass, guitar. I mean, early on, Marcia didn't even play the keys. When the band first started, Marcia was like just playing the sax.
Okay.
Because we were like, oh yeah, it's like a ska band, so you need to like have a horn. Like Marcia's dad like has a sax. She plays the flute. She can like figure out how to play the sax. That was literally like the thinking behind that.
Okay.
And then she was like, you know, very versed at the piano as well. So wasn't even until like a couple years into it that like, I think maybe even when we first started like making like our first record or something like that, that we were even like, oh yeah, my Marcia can play like an organ or something like that. You know what I mean? We weren't even, wasn't even like at that level yet. So
yeah.
Yeah. But to be fair, myself and Jamie and a little later on Marcia were like, we were pretty like into like the songwriting and having original music kind of from the get-go.
Oh, okay, great. And then, so it's nice when you have a core that are into the same things in many different ways. You know, you say in the reggae, the ska, the punk was the foundation of the band. And right away, it sounds like everybody wanted to get into the original music, which is obviously, if you want to have a career, is with the direction you want to go. So how did the formulation of music and songs come about and the songwriting, and what were you guys writing about? And did you guys collaborate, or did somebody come with an idea and you start playing some music to it? Or how did the formation of the original music come about?
That's a really good question. I would say that it's actually, and still to this day, like 14 years later, like there is no straight one method for a skink song.
Right.
You know, even now, you know, there's definitely been like songs over the years that have followed like a similar like methodic trajectory as others, whereby, you know, there are certain songs where like someone's basically like written the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
maybe acoustically or something. And then it's kind of, the song is kind of already complete when it comes to the band in terms of it's a song, but then like, you know, the harmonies and the instrument arrangements and stuff will kind of be more collaborated by everyone.
Okay.
And there's certain ideas where it's like somebody just has like a hook, somebody just has a verse, and then the rest of us will really get involved. Or, you know, like I've written stuff for like the others to sing.
Okay.
Because I thought it would be better suited to a different voice, or, you know, or Marcia's like written a chorus and she's like, okay, cool. Well, I want like a different kind of perspective on the verses. So can you write a lyric for the verses? It's really across all our records, man. It's been like, I wouldn't say like for every song there's a set formula. It's kind of different. But I think, you know, where we like explore like quite a lot stylistically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense that that's the case. I don't think we would have the catalog we have,
mm-hmm.
if we kind of approached everything in the same
creative
process, if that makes sense.
Let's take an example. So let's pick a song. I want to pick an early song, say like Bright Girl, since that's one of my early favorites. She's a good girl down deep down. She's a good girl down deep down. She's a good girl down. Why don't we talk about the process with a song like that, so we people can really understand, a prime example, something, a true example of that. So how did that song come about?
Okay, yeah, I remember that song coming about, man. That was Jamie, I believe, actually kind of had been at home messing around with a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Had actually written the song about his younger sister at the time.
Okay.
And so he kind of like came to us with like, I don't know, maybe he didn't even come to us. He might have, we were just, these times in the early days, I mean, we're all grown ups now and we will see each other still. But like at that time, we were all like, we were playing gigs and we were like hanging out all the time as well as buddies, like, you know what I mean, in our friendship circle. So in those days, it was like we would be hanging out and just, and like the songs are forming, like not even necessarily in a rehearsal scenario. We just might be at our buddy's house with a guitar. Okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was kind of like one of those scenarios. Yeah, and Jamie kind of had the kind of little like blue beat, like swing.
Yeah.
Kind of intro thing with like the do 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 do.
Yeah.
And all that. Yeah, Jamie had pretty much written that song mostly fully formed from the get-go, to be honest with you, and then we kind of just did up the arrangement and harmonies when we were like in the practice room with all the drums and amps set up, you know.
Nice. Well, I also want to, you know, there's a little bit of a cultural difference between, say, us in America and obviously the English, and we're a byproduct of England, but you guys have some different slogans and words that you use. Like, for instance, I what is the meaning behind the band name, the Skints?
Yeah, the Skints. Funny enough, the band name doesn't actually grammatically is grammatically incorrect, you know, even though it's kind of technically a whatever, a colloquial slang word. So to be skint,
mm-hmm,
is just to be like, it's kind of just to be a bit, I'm kind of broke right now, a bit hard up. Like, yeah, if you said, Lance, like, Josh, can you like lend me $20? And be like, oh man, I'm skint right now. Like,
yeah.
It's kind of like that. But like skints with an S on the end, like plurally, doesn't actually make sense. But when we were teenagers, I thought it sounded like a cool name for a band, you know? So
I love it. I wanted to. Well, that maybe you guys were all skints. You were all broke at the time. And
yeah, know, man. Yeah, that's it. Basically.
Moving forward, when did you guys start doing, I mean, because the shows and the tour ethic is, I mean, you guys got a hardcore work ethic as far as touring and doing shows. How did those start and where did they start?
I mean, they're always the want to play live was like pretty much instant. Honestly, we were probably playing shows like before we should have been, you know what I mean? in terms of like the rehearsal and material and stuff, there was just, the hunger was just there,
mm-hmm,
from, you know, it's what we wanted to do when we were kids. Like the first goal of the band was to play at this now defunct local music venue, which was called The Standard, which was like this old club on a Black Horse Road in Walthamstow, which was kind of like the middle of where we all live. We still rehearse just up the street to this day.
Nice.
But, you know, that was kind of the mission, was to play there. And then it just once you did that, you know, it's taken me actually years to realize, but it kind of, it never ends. Like the next goal,
mm-hmm,
never ends. Like when you do it, you know what I mean? Like after this, it was like, okay, write a song, write a set, play a gig, play more gigs, play this place, play that place, play, you know, north, south, east, west London, play outside of London, do a tour of the UK. Do you know what I mean? It's just like the steps,
yeah,
just never stopped, you know what I mean? And until you get, you know, to where we are now, which is 4 albums deep and having traveled the world and still want to do it. But yeah, those, the early shows, man, it was a lot of like just you know, making connections with other bands and a lot of like, yeah, just a lot of like email hustling and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah,
I remember those early days. And yeah, because we're like a band that's existed like since the decline of the music industry,
right?
You know what I mean? Like we're a band that's into existed in a post-internet generation. So we've kind of always had that, like, to a degree and, like, to a developing degree through the course of our career, obviously, over 14 years, like, social media and kind of being able to get in touch with people directly.
Yeah.
Has kind of always been there. You know what I mean? Which I think, well, we're definitely not like a big internet band in terms of like a TikTok sensation or
right
millions of followers. Like, it's definitely our path and the way we've done things has definitely been like undoubtedly been a result of that, you know?
Yeah, sad, Danny. Yeah, I mean, that's a good perspective because a lot of people can relate to that nowadays because you're able to get opportunities before. I mean, now than you were before, like you had to have a record label and they had all the connections and
sure.
You had to go through them and have a booking agent. Now you can do, it's DIY. You can do it all yourself now, which has, and you guys have remained very independent since day one, which is a blessing in itself. And you guys have been able to pretty much control your destiny with your hustle, with your work ethic, with your, you know, making those connections. And I mean, it seems early on you made connections like right away with the Slackers and bands like the Agrolites and Chris Murray and, you know, even Random Head, you know, these are, you know, and then shortly after it's Sublime and Real Big Fish, which are big bands here in the U.S., you know, and talk a little bit about those days, like you say, moving up, and how did you, was it this type of platform that you used to get out to these bands, to open up for these bands and tour with these bands?
Yeah, I mean, we had, so I would say probably by the end of 2008, whilst we've never necessarily had like big labels or big management or anything, we have worked with booking agents mm-hmm. for a whole time. And I would say, well, until pre-pandemic, I would say that most bands that are looking to have a decent live career, you know, more important than your record label or your management is the person that's booking your shows and getting you on the road.
Right.
Ultimately, obviously those guys have been having a tough time of it for the last 18 months or so, but
yeah,
you know, it's kind of been our thing, you know, is booking agent connections. Yeah. By the end of 2008, we were kind of with like the main kind of underground punk rock agent out here in the UK, which is how we kind of got hooked up with, like you say, those names like the Slackers, the Agrolites, Chris Murray and stuff. How we ended up opening for them. And I think by the end of 2010, we started working with Ross, who is still our agent to this day over here. Yeah, which is when we start to play with like the Real Big Fishes, Sublime with Rome, Better in Soundclash, these kind of bands, you know?
Yeah.
But also, you got to remember at the time, and possibly even still now, like we did a lot of those tours because there really weren't a lot of bands of our ilk that were kind of trying, you know what I mean? That were kind of as hungry and up for it and wanted it and available as us, who would go and do everything at like the drop of a hat. You know, I remember when we first played with like Sublime and Bedouin Soundclash, we were like out just doing like a toilet tour of the UK, which is just like, you know, basically a dive bar tour.
Yeah.
In the UK, which is a small country. And we were out for like 4 weeks and then getting the offers coming through like, oh, Sublime need an opener, Better need an opener, and just staying out on the road and like jumping on that and stuff as well. And
right.
Just really committing like any, like everything we had to, just being out there, man, and getting in front of any new audience that felt relevant in any way. And in some cases weren't relevant in any way, but there was still a new audience, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you got on from early. It sounds like you got on with the right bands. And did it ever come a time where you're like, oh, who do we go with this time? We have Sublime here and we have the Agrolites here. Which band do we want to go? And then we have this new band, you know, do you want to go with the new audience? Do you want to go with the more core audience? Did you ever have those situations where there were choices to be made? And what made you make those choices?
Maybe like much later down the line, to be honest with you, with those situations occurred, early days, there wasn't really, early days, we would just do everything that we could, you know, and I would say it was maybe like years later down the line when the band that we actually have our own following and worth, and you know, and then like you're kind of getting offers, and then it kind of gets a bit more political, money comes into play, you know, other stuff you're doing, like some tours or festivals want you to have like exclusivity to their territory as part of the book, you know what I mean, like this kind of stuff comes into play. But that's probably like in the last, I don't know, like five, 6 years or so. That's pretty more a situation.
Would you be open to explaining a particular situation, like one of those situations arose, or is that something you would share?
Okay, so there's a situation I can think of where there was like a tour in 2016 that maybe that we were being offered, that I get, you know, in principle we like wanted to do.
Okay.
But the fee to do the tour would have meant us losing money,
right,
even though the band was cool. And then there was another tour that we were offered at the same time that was shorter, but we were definitely going to make money. And then following that, we were also about to go to the US with Sublime with Rome,
okay,
where it's very expensive for us to come there. So the kind of make money tour, to be able to afford to then do the US tour,
okay,
just in business terms, had to be done, as much as the other tour, we're all fans of that band and it would have been great, but it just fiscally, like,
right,
it just couldn't happen. Yeah, something like that.
So let's say the US tour didn't happen, would you have gone with the other band where you lost money? Do you think it would have been a situation like that?
I think at that point, like, I mean, like, even to this day, man, like, the stuff with the money is, like, so tight. I think forward thinking, beneficial-wise, to be in a position to make money versus lose it at that point, like, we would have just had to.
Yeah.
And it, both were great, you know what I mean? It wasn't like do something that sucks versus do something that's great.
Right.
They were both great opportunities, and we're lucky to be in that position to even have that choice. So,
right.
Yeah. After however many years of like breaking even or losing money or something, sometimes it's just like to move forward, to be afforded a position to profit on a tour, it's just sometimes necessary for whatever you want to do next, whether it's touring the US or record or even the next domestic tour, like, sometimes you just need to profit to move forward.
Of course. Well, you know, it's good to hear that coming from a band, because, you know, anybody
in, it's not the coolest thing to say either, you know?
No, of course not. But it's good to hear, because people are out there and there might be a young band and they're like, you know, we keep losing money, you know, but we got to get our name out there. And it's good to hear somebody actually put it out there, because everybody has to go through that. Whether, you know, people on the outside, the fans don't know that, but people in the business do, you know.
Sure.
So it's like, it's good to put it in perspective, even for the fan, because then they really know the hardships that we go through in this business, You understand?
Yeah, man, the overheads are high, man. Like, even when you see, like, I mean, we don't have a particularly expensive ticket price, in my opinion, but I think it's difficult for people to understand, like, all they're seeing is, like, the cost of everything, like, the cost of the ticket, the cost of a T-shirt from, like, a retail
right
perspective. But actually, I promise you, like, when you break it down and that when there's everything and everybody to pay for,
yep,
the back end is not what you think it is. I promise.
Yeah. No, of course. Of course. You know, talking about hardships with a band and everything, I know there was a time that you guys basically had all your equipment got stolen. Walk us through that. What happened and how did you guys recover?
Yeah, man, that was a rough day. Well, we're going back to like 2012. We had done a show. We had two shows. We'd done one, and then we had an off day, in which the van was parked outside my parents' old house, and then we were playing another show the next day, and on that off day, someone got it, man. Yeah.
Wow.
Someone stole it from outside my parents' place and had everything in it.
Jeez. And
so it was like a real kick in the teeth at that point. We just put our second record out. We had to buy everything back, man. I mean, the good people at Banquet Records down in Kingston, England, not Jamaica. They put on a show where, like, well, we played the show, obviously, but that was kind of like a benefit show to help us buy some stuff back. And had a couple really generous fans and stuff who just, like, basically just donated some money to us to help us get back what we could. And just everything we were playing for that summer was basically buying all the gear back. But,
right.
Yeah, that was a really that was a dark day, man, that really could have ended us, you know, but luckily it didn't and we moved forward. But from that day, we never kept equipment in the van overnight in London ever again.
Yeah, that happened. That, you know, it definitely happens. I've seen it happen. It's happened to myself as well. So it's definitely a hardship, but, you know, I think it, in your guys' case, it kind of gave you some faith in people that believed in you.
Definitely.
You know, and it just goes to show not only that, but your second album was basically paid for by your fans as well, correct?
Correct. Yeah. It was like a crowdfunded situation there.
So, you know, I mean, hard times can be turned into something good. And that is, to me, that seems like that. If you look to the good, there's lots of good there as well, you know?
Yeah, of course, man. It's all part of the story as well. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, since we've talked a lot about your touring and some of the shows, you know, and as time goes on, you've done bigger shows and, you know, a highlight for you guys in your career at that time, being from that area of the world, that is such a big, big festival, you know, but you guys first put out what was the first song you ever released? I want to talk a little bit more about the recordings. You go through some of the recording history.
Okay. Well, the first EP we put out was back in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really a singles scenario. It was just kind of the EP.
Okay.
So
there was no single before that EP. It was just an EP release.
Nah, it was just an EP. Like, I don't even, like, those times we weren't even, like, thinking in terms of singles. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was just like, yeah, probably like whatever songs go. It was pretty like MySpace these times. It was like whatever couple songs go in your MySpace or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then a year later is when we did our first album. But again, we didn't really do singles. I don't really remember being a singles for that album. Maybe Murderer was one. She's a murderer. She's a murderer.
Okay.
maybe Mindless was one. Honestly, don't really, because we didn't even make a music video on our first album. You know what I mean? It was just kind of the album,
right?
What I remember. And then it was maybe around the time of our second record. I think like the first like official single was maybe like, maybe it was the Katie B cover, Katie on a Mission, or Rat a Tat maybe was like the first single. I know you're a bit of control, you could be a little better, better, yet a better friend of me. Instead of
I know you can get a life and no other hearing, knocking on your door with a rat tat tat. I know. What was the name of the first EP?
It was just self-titled, it was just the Skins EP.
Okay. And then what was it? Believe? What was the first
Live
album?
Live Breathe Build Believe.
Yeah, and that's the one that had Bright Girl on it, correct?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of when you guys popped up on my radar.
Cool.
And then you guys came out with FM, correct?
Then it was Part and Parcel.
Part and Parcel, yeah, that's the one that was crowdfunded.
Sure, yeah. And then FM, and then Swimming Lessons most recently.
Talk about the second album a little bit. Or you know, even conceptually, you know, talk a little bit about the EP. Like, what were you guys going for? Were you guys happy with the music?
Yeah, the EP was just like, it was like our first kind of proper recording experience. It was made in just a couple of days, man. Do you know what I mean? Kids let loose in a recording studio doing their thing. Yeah, like I remember it just being like a fun couple of days. And then our first album, like a year later, that was kind of like, I remember that was a really good time in my life, man. We made the album in like 5 days. I think we came back like 2 weeks later for like 2 days mixing or something.
Wow.
That was like out in the countryside, man. That was like out in Devon. So probably like a 4 or 5 hour drive out of London, which really felt like an adventure for us at the time.
Nice.
To like go and be in the countryside and just there for a week, working like all around the clock, just to make, which was basically the 10 songs that make our first album was basically like our set at the time.
Okay.
If you listen to it, you can kind of hear like a lot of the songs like actually like play into each other.
Okay.